Alabama is a deeply conservative place, as its voting record demonstrates. Democrat Doug Jones scored a stunning victory this week in Alabama's U.S. Senate race. Voters chose the 63-year-old former prosecutor to fill Attorney General Jeff Sessions' former seat. It's where we begin this week in review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Chris Lotto is a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning, Kate.
Good morning. John Nichols also joins us. He's the associate editor of the Capital Times and national affairs correspondent of The Nation magazine. John, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, Doug Jones is going to Washington. That was the decision this week when voters elected Doug Jones, the first Democratic U.S. Senator in Alabama in 25 years. In the state's special election. Let's listen to a clip from his acceptance speech.
I have always believed that the people of Alabama had more in common than to divide us. We have shown not just around the state of Alabama, but we have shown the country the way that we can be unified.
John, let's start with you. What do you make of this special election, and does it indicate anything about the 2018 midterms?
Oh, I think it indicates a lot, but we should be a little careful. I've been obviously very critical over the years of the evolution of the Republican Party toward a much more right-wing set of stances, but I don't think the party had evolved all the way to Roy Moore. And so really what you had in Alabama was this great struggle on what will the Republican Party be when it grows up. If Roy Moore had won, Steve Bannon would have been dramatically enhanced in his power. And I think that Trump would have erred more on the side of Bannon. I think you would have seen a real change in the internal definition of the Republican Party and a very damaging one for the party. They escaped that. So in a sense, this is a good result for a lot of Republicans. As regards to Democrats, it was also important for them. And here's what was key. Doug Jones was a capable, credible candidate. He ran a capable, credible campaign. Traditionally, in a state like Alabama, that would not have been sufficient. Roy Moore was certainly a factor in why it was sufficient, narrowly. But also, I think that there was clearly a reaction against Donald Trump. And it's interesting that Doug Jones was elected because of overwhelming turnout by African-American voters, African-American women in particular, 98% of them voting for Doug Jones. And if that sort of mobilization continues into 2018, not just based off a Roy Moore candidacy, but based off a reaction to Donald Trump, there are certainly a lot of places where Democrats could win where they haven't won in recent years. So it teaches us a lot, but I would still keep that one caution in. Rarely will Democrats have a candidate as bad as Roy Moore to run against.
Okay, so Chris, what do you make of the turnout and this election?
Sure. I agree with John on a couple of points. I think Republicans dodged a bullet here because had Roy Moore won, we would have been right into ethics hearings and everything else. Frankly, he is a loose cannon who probably would have been hung around Republicans' necks going into the midterms. It would not have reflected well potentially on other Republican candidates. So, I do think we dodged a bullet. Roy Moore was a deeply flawed candidate, and that's putting it mildly. But I would caution against Democrats seeing this race as much of a reliable bellwether for 2018, and there are a few reasons for that. I mean, in this case, it was very clearly the candidate himself, Roy Moore, who lost this race. I mean, this is a deep red state we're talking about. They haven't elected a Democrat senator since 1992. And even with Roy Moore as the candidate and all the baggage and all the stuff he brought with him, he still came pretty close to winning. I mean, he lost by, I don't know if the final numbers are in yet, but he lost by less than 2 points as it stands. So, frankly, now it's time for Republicans to step away and forget about Roy Moore once and for all and look ahead to 2018. The Alabama GOP has said it's not going to support a recount, which Roy Moore has been indicating he wants. I think that's the first big step toward the party getting its act together, embracing some of the battles to come. And remember, too, that Doug Jones outraised more, I think, by something like a 5-1 margin. And Alabama was a state that Trump won by nearly 30 points just a year ago. So these are all signs that, to me, suggest it was the candidate alone, certainly along with the sexual misconduct allegations against Moore. Those clearly hurt him. I don't think this is necessarily some sort of massive anti-GOP sea change.
Chris, what do you make of Roy Moore refusing to concede the race?
I guess it's within his right to make noise. I think he just looks like a spoil sport at this point. I think the margin is too big to trigger an automatic recount in Alabama, if my facts are right. I think the guy's got to step aside, and I think, you know, every day he is out there making, you know, proclamations and everything else, he is hurting himself even more. So not a fan, and I think the party needs to start doing the right thing. And as I said, with the Alabama GOP, they're certainly stepping away, and I think it's time for us to move on and forget about Roy Moore and get ready for 2018.
Let's bring in John from Somerset on this. Hi, John, go ahead.
Hi, how are you? I was just wondering about this Roy Moore election. You know, I guess felons can vote, and they don't count the military, and then they had to go to court to stop them from destroying the digital ballots, you know. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, John.
Yes, I just think this is the Democratic corruption machine at work here in this election with Roy Moore.
Well, John, thanks for calling in. The Democratic corruption machine at work. What do you make of that, John?
There's plenty of corruption in our politics on all sides. But when I look at what happened in Alabama, you know, certainly, as Chris said, Roy Moore has a right to ask for a recount. And certainly every candidate has a right and a responsibility to demand that every vote be counted. They have a Republican Secretary of State in Alabama who seems to be a pretty responsible guy. I know that there's a lot of fantasy flying around on the Internet about, you know, all sorts of things. The fact is the military ballots will be counted. By most accounts, the voting went off pretty well. And one of the things that I think is important to understand about this, and I think a lot of people who are hyper-partisan will get lost in this. They will, you know, have all their dreams and hopes in it. Here's the fundamental reality. Roy Moore was a fundamentally flawed candidate. He had a little trouble getting the whole of the Republican base out. Doug Jones, people need to understand this. He's been way undercovered as a candidate. He was a remarkable figure. He's a native Alabaman who had worked on the Senate Judiciary Committee, become a federal prosecutor, and devoted an immense amount of his life to prosecuting Klansmen who had killed four little girls at the Birmingham church in 1963. At his victory party, the younger sister of one of the girls who was killed was there celebrating. Quietly. She wasn't making a big deal. She was just in the crowd. Some photographer recognized her. People need to understand that for African-American voters and for righteous voters of all races and all backgrounds, Doug Jones was not merely a Democratic candidate. He was an incredibly impressive contender. And so I would be very cautious about trying to take away his victory by suggesting there was some sort of corruption machine. I think it was a genuine victory.
Just a follow-up on that, what do you think the role of the Me Too movement and sexual assault and misconduct allegations had to do in this election?
Well, I think it's huge nationally. This is a sea change moment. And my sense is that in Alabama, it was some element of Me Too. And I think there are some women and some men who were influenced by these broader issues. But I would counsel that Roy Moore was a bigger mess even than the sexual molestation charges against him. There were questions of fraud. There were questions of just outright racism. And this is a guy who was thrown off the state Supreme Court out of his job as Chief Justice two times. And so I do think there's an intersection there of a lot of things in play. But yeah, I mean, we should not underestimate that one of the things that the Me Too movement is saying is that you have to listen to women who step up and raise these issues. And I do think that had some influence.
Chris, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called on Republicans on Wednesday morning to hit pause on their tax bill following Doug Jones's victory in Alabama. He said it would be wrong for them to push the bill through without giving Jones an opportunity to cast a vote. What do you think about this? Is this reasonable to ask?
Yeah, it's reasonable to ask, and it's also reasonable for Republican leadership to say, no, we're going to press ahead. They are not incumbent. Republicans are not incumbent on Chuck Schumer to wait until the Democrats' new guy is installed before taking action. They don't have to wait. So Democrats are within their rights to ask, and Republicans, as the leaders in Congress, have a right to say, no, that's okay. We're gonna work to get this done. And as you know, the discussions have been going on. The plans have been morphing quite a bit in recent days. But we know there are some key elements of that we're going to see. And it's going to be big, and it's going to be important. And there's a reason why there's certainly good feeling among Republicans in Congress because there's going to be some great action happening on taxes. We know in general that the bill is going to allow people to deduct up to $10,000 for state and local taxes. There's going to be higher tax rates for cash and assets that companies have put overseas. There are other expected middle class tax breaks that are coming, a deduction on student loan interest, bigger mortgage interest deduction. At this time, from what we're hearing, the plan is expected to be considered and passed next week. The president has indicated that he will then move very fast once it's passed to implement it. So there's a lot of good news here in this tax bill for an economy that is already surging under President Trump. And for those who are still seeking jobs in a job market that is already pretty strong in the U.S.
Well, and shifting the conversation to the tax bill, here's the president on the process.
As a candidate, I promised we would pass a massive tax cut for the everyday working American families who are the backbone and the heartbeat of our country. Now we're just days away. I hope. You know what that means, right? From keeping that promise and delivering a truly amazing victory for American families. We want to give you, the American people, a giant tax cut for Christmas. And when I say giant, I mean giant.
And so President Trump also announced that the changes would take effect early next year. Do you think this push is going to come true, Chris?
I do, and I realize that's probably going out on a bit of a limb, but maybe not so much. I think there's momentum in the right direction. We saw yesterday there was sort of a hitch in the plans, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Marco Rubio was among Republican senators who indicated they were holding out for a bigger child tax credit that would benefit lower income earners. So I think the delays and the sort of last minute finagling that we're seeing in Washington amongst Republicans is all for the good, because they want to make sure that this package of tax reforms and tax cuts is as comprehensive as it can be, and make sure that middle and lower income earners are seeing the benefits that they deserve too. In addition to the tax cuts for businesses at the higher level, that is going to spur economic development. It's going to spur job growth. It's going to spur economic expansion in the U.S. So, there's a lot of good things. I'll say that yes, it is going to get done, and I think that it's going to be very beneficial for the people of the U.S. and for taxpayers.
So John Nichols, Senator Marco Rubio wanted yesterday to hold out here and shift more of the benefit to low and middle income families and less on corporations to receive the benefit. What do you think of that?
Well, I think I'm always for that, as I think basically everybody except Scrooge is in favor of. I'm intrigued that this bill is portrayed as a Christmas gift for the American people, in the sense that it might be that, if you look at some of the top line and some of the very nice things that Chris just ran through. But it's a Christmas gift that is bought on credit, and the bill comes due, and makes for a very cold coming year and years ahead. This is a disastrous plan. It is poorly designed. It goes against the basic premises of the Republican Party and the conservative movement in a desperation move to try and do something before the year is done. Their campaign donors have told them They have to do something. That the Virginia and New Jersey results, and some might even suggest Mississippi, or I'm sorry, might even suggest Alabama, point to a problem for the party that looks like it's a do-nothing Congress. And so they've enforced a loyalty here to something that they have taught us over the years not to accept, massive movements of money which aren't paid for and thus end up running tremendous deficits. I'll say one other thing quickly. There are always going to be partisan fights over a bill of this sort. And you certainly had that with the Reagan tax cuts, and particularly the ones in the later 80s. But a good tax plan looks to the future. It tries to anticipate where the economy and where society is going. This tax plan is incredibly backward. It sort of recycles ideas from the 1970s and early 1980s. The fact of the matter is we're 30 years into a globalization revolution. We're 20 years into a digital revolution. We're 10 years, 8 years into an automation revolution. These things are changing everything about how we do business, how we communicate, how we operate. This bill does not address that. In fact, some of the tax breaks for businesses actually will encourage robotification of our factories. Now, that's not a terrible thing. That's going to happen. But people who think that this is somehow going to create a lot of jobs just because there are investments are really, it's as if the last 50 years didn't occur. And so I have never seen so backward a tax bill as this one. People who vote for this will dramatically regret it.
Let's go to Jim in Janesville on this. Jim, go ahead.
Yes, this tax reform bill is not going to promote job wage increase. It's going to do the opposite. It's going to send more jobs overseas. This tax bill, I hope it fails. I really do, because it's just a big giveaway to the rich and the big corporations.
Well, and Chris, your last word on this before we take a break here, what would you say? Will this push jobs overseas?
I mean, you know, look, the idea, you know, John, what John said is true. We are moving generally in that direction, but I don't think that necessarily this tax bill is not reflective of reality. And, you know, it's funny how, you know, Democrats who never seemed to be all that worried about deficit spending when Obama was president are suddenly going, whoa, 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 and suddenly become deficit hawks out of nowhere. That's amusing. And I think the fact that, you know, you are going to see anything that probably will not have much, if any, Democrat support, because after all, 2018 is right around the corner, and you sure wouldn't want to back something that President Trump wants to see. So this is probably going to be done very much along partisan lines. But I do think ultimately that it will be good for the American people. And the goal is to put more money in the hands of middle-income earners and lower-income earners as well.
But all analysis says it does not. All of the analysis coming in says it will not do that.
All I can do is point to the tax cuts and the package that is being discussed now. And, I would say that you have to give the final plan a chance to get out there and be reviewed. But that is what the indications are. That is what senators like Marco Rubio are fighting for. The fact is you will see tax cuts. I mean, you will see middle-income earners and lower-income earners have more money in their pockets. That's just a fact. And the fact also is that if you're cutting the corporate rate, that is going to allow them to make more investments in infrastructure, more investments in jobs and the economy and job growth. That will in turn generate more revenue, which goes back to the U.S. government and can help address any of the deficits that come as a result of it. I mean, that is the cycle that you'll see as a result of this.
We are in Week in Review on this 15th of December. Chris Lotto is here. He's a GOP campaign consultant, and we have John Nichols, associate editor of the Capital Times. You as well in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What do you think of the FCC's vote on net neutrality yesterday? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back shortly to discuss on the Ideas Network. The FCC scrapped the so-called net neutrality regulations yesterday that prohibited broadband providers from blocking websites or charging for higher quality service or certain content. The FCC chairman said the rollback of the net neutrality rules would eventually help consumers because broadband providers like AT&T and Comcast would offer people a wider variety of service options. One of the topics on this Week in Review, it's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Chris Lotto is a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. He's with us. John Nichols as well, associate editor of the Capital Times and national affairs correspondent of The Nation magazine. You can join the conversation, 800-642 1234. What about Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation? Are Republicans right to be concerned about partisanship in the Russia investigation? Let's go straight to Ned in Lake Dubay. Ned, go ahead.
Yes, this week the Republicans complained about bias in the Mueller investigation. And this is when Mueller is getting near the release of very important information that's closing in on Donald Trump. This is laying the foundation so that when Trump fires Mueller, I hope that doesn't happen, but if it does, they're laying the foundation for people to accept this. Mueller is essential because the House and Senate committees mostly fight among themselves, especially the House committee, and only Mueller can bring the criminal investigation charges. We know that the Russians have bought TV ads to swing the election. The evidence has come out recently showing the purchase of those TV ads. And in May of this year, there were no complaints against Robert Mueller by anybody.
Well, let's
finally, fire Flynn and Manafort cooperating with Mueller if there's nothing in the Russian investigation. They wouldn't be cooperating with them unless there was something to this.
Point made. Let's get Chris in here to respond. Chris, go ahead.
Well, to start with, the Justice Department and FBI this week are having real issues with credibility and objectivity, and it's formed a bit of a cloud over the entire investigation. The question is legitimate. Why are FBI agents involved here exchanging anti-Trump texts before the 2016 election, alluding to the idea that they can't, quote, take the risk of Trump being elected? To what degree are these investigators and their anti-Trump feelings permeating the investigation? I think for all the grief that Trump catches for continuing to bring up Hillary Clinton and her emails, the fact is that we saw very, very different standards of treatment between how investigators have used kid gloves to handle Clinton. And there are numerous cases and points that we can make on that. And Clinton and her team, when they ducked and dodged around who knew what about the Clinton home email server, whether Clinton even understood the top secret magnitude of some of the emails that she handled, versus how investigators went after Paul Manafort, for example, with guns drawn in a pre-dawn raid at his house when he was already cooperating with authorities. Now, I'm not going to deny that this is serious business, and the investigators' judgment and handling of the case and how it may be colored bipartisanship is suspect. Is there an issue with Russia meddling in the 2016 election that deserves investigation? Absolutely. But the questions that are being raised as we see more information come out about those running the investigation is also a legitimate question.
John, is even-handedness here out the window?
I don't think so. None of this touches on Mueller. This is the standard theater that both parties engage in. It reminds me a lot of what we went through with, remember the great fascination with Benghazi for a long time, right, up until the election was done, and then suddenly it's kind of disappeared. Political parties and political operatives spin issues up, spin controversies up in hopes of creating distractions from the heart of the matter. But the fact is that Mueller is a pro. He'll continue on the track that he's on. I doubt he'll be dissuaded by this. And also, I have real doubts about whether Donald Trump will fire him. I know that that's a favorite fantasy of some of the right-wing talk radio and TV. But the fact of the matter is, if Donald Trump were to fire Robert Mueller at this point, when he has roughly a 32-33% approval rating, this is President Trump, it would be gasoline on the fire. It would cause a situation where not just Democrats, but responsible Republicans, and I want to emphasize, there are responsible Republicans in Congress, more of them than people think. I talk to them. They would step up. And of course, it would begin an inquiry into impeachment. And let us not, we should not be cautious about this. The answer to a president who tries to shut down an inquiry that is getting close to him, as the founders intended, was impeachment. And I would argue that at that point, you would have Democrats and some Republicans entertaining the issue appropriately. So we have the bad theater of the moment. We'll have bad theater every week going forward. We'll have people bringing up Hillary Clinton, who I understand recently resigned as president of Fox News, jokingly, because they treat her so much as if she was elected president. But at the end of the day, where this is headed is toward an accountability moment. And the accountability moment will come very close to Donald Trump. It may get to him. This is a very big deal, and it ought to be seen through as far as it can go.
Well, Ned, thank you so much for calling in with your point. Now, this is a really quick blip on the screen here. Yesterday, it came through that a Politico report, Speaker Paul Ryan's future caught the eye of many of us. The report indicated Ryan has informed some of plans to step down as House Speaker after the 2018 midterm elections. However, House Speaker Paul Ryan denied the report, said he planned to leave Congress after 2018 election, and an aide called the story pure speculation. Chris, what's going on here?
Well, if it's true, first of all, it would be a shame, and I'm sure that Wisconsin and national Republicans are pretty united on that point. He is absolutely among the best of the best Republicans have at both the state and national levels. But this has been an unbelievably stressful year for the speaker. I mean, this is an often thankless job to begin with, and it's become even more challenging in the age of Trump. So the news is very disappointing if it's true, and it's perhaps not totally surprising that he might be mulling his exit. You'll recall that, he publicly indicated before taking the job that he was reluctant to move into the speaker's post. But, of course, publicly he has to continue to be fully engaged as the leader. He can't appear to be a lame duck. He's indicated he wants to take on potentially some more really big reforms in the coming year, such as entitlement reform. And depending on how the midterm elections go next year, granted they are still a ways off, this could be Paul Ryan's last best shot at achieving some of those reforms in the next year. Now, all that said, we've heard from the man himself, we've heard from his spokesperson that he's not going anywhere anytime soon. So in the absence of, on the record, firsthand reports from folks who are being named, This could also be an effort to build momentum for the narrative of a wounded GOP in the wake of the Alabama Senate election this week. So, in other words, I would say take these reports with a big grain of salt.
And John Nichols.
Well, I tend to agree with most of what Chris said there, especially about the fact that the speaker's exhausted. This has been an incredibly difficult 2 years. Remember, 2.5 years ago, people were talking about him as potentially the Republican candidate for president. He's ended up as an errand boy for Donald Trump. I mean, that's a pretty miserable fall. He is not up to the job of Speaker. He has not managed the House well. On basic premises of the party, he has struggled to keep his coalitions together and often bent toward extremes that were so far out that when the House actually did pass something, it was unacceptable to the Senate. And so he's not in control of the position he's in. He doesn't handle it well. In addition, his lifelong obsession with going after Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security has caught up with him. He's in a high-profile position now, and even as they're doing this tax bill, he couldn't help himself and start talking about going at Medicare and Medicaid. And that's certainly something that will register well with Wall Street, right? But it registers horribly with America. And even in his own home district now, there's such tension and such disenchantment, I think, with him. He's still got a gerrymandered district. He's probably viable there. But the fact of the matter is, you look at where Paul Ryan's at this point, I actually, if he is considering getting out, I have more respect for him than I would otherwise, because he's somebody who at least realizes his miserable circumstance.
Well, we have to move on now. U.S. Telecom regulators voted to repeal so-called net neutrality rules, which restrict the power of internet service providers to influence loading speeds for specific websites or apps. The vote yesterday fell along party lines and loosened Obama-era regulations for internet providers. Let's bring in Leah in Milwaukee on that news. Leah, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I think this is just a travesty. I'm a millennial. I've only ever known, you know, an open and free internet. And to think, you know, as part of the whole here, if you're looking holistically, this is just another step by Trump's FCC to pad the pockets of billionaires and millionaires and corporations. That's all that this is going to do. To think that my internet service provider like Comcast or Spectrum would have the power over what I can see or be able to charge me to get to information that should absolutely be my right as a U.S. citizen, I think that is just an abomination. And I think it's part of this whole thing around padding the pockets with the Trump tax scam, with opening up the Arctic to drilling, with, you know, fast-tracking the Keystone Pipeline.
This is
all part of the same concerted narrative, the same concerted, well-funded effort to just give gifts.
Got it, Leah. Thank you so much. John, it sounds like this is resonating among multiple generations here, this net neutrality vote.
Well, it is a generational reality. The younger you get, the more you understand that this is a horrible, horrible move. The older you get, there's some folks who are, you know, not as fully engaged with the internet as they will be. Remember, the internet really is the future. It's not just the future of business or commerce. It's the future of how we communicate. It's the future of how politics will operate. Democracy itself will evolve as we see the internet evolve. So this is a very big deal. At my kid's school, she's 14, there were kids talking. It's a big issue at school because they were aware that there was a threat to the internet as they have only known it. And, you know, here's the bottom line to understand here. This is not a complicated reality. Net neutrality is the First Amendment of the internet. It is the guarantee that all speech will be treated equally and respected and move at the same speed. What Chairman Pai and the majority on the FCC has done has created a circumstance that would allow telecommunications companies who have lost the ability to make a lot of money in other areas and are desperate to get into the internet and colonize it for their own purposes, to come in and create a two-track system where corporations and powerful individuals who pay a lot of money will have the fastest delivery, where grassroots groups, citizens, will have a slower level of delivery as regards how internet comes at you. Leah's right that there may also be more charges to consumers. I expect that is the case. But even more important is this reality of a two-tier internet where the messages of economic and political elites move faster than the messages of the grassroots and of citizens. This is a terrible circumstance in a democracy, and it is one that must be understood, again, as we understand the First Amendment.
Chris,
you can't have net neutrality.
Let's let Chris have a word here. Chris, good move, bad move, where do you stand?
Well, I'm struck by John's final point, and I think it's an interesting one, and I think that the idea that net neutrality doesn't exist any longer certainly opens it up to abuses on both sides of the aisle. Yes, Republicans are in here now taking this action, but certainly Democrats down the road would also have the opportunity and ability to abuse the loss of net neutrality powers as well. So I think this could cut both ways. And the idea that another party, if they were in power, wouldn't take advantage of some of that, like John is saying, I think you're living in fantasy land. Now, as a Republican, I understand what the arguments are in support of the FCC decision this week. And the argument on a certain level does make sense. Why should internet service providers be forced to provide unlimited equal access to any and all internet content? It's not making the content illegal to access. It's potentially requiring consumers to pay a premium to get that access to some content. And that is, in a sense, what free market capitalism is all about, which is to say the reduction of government regulations, and you pay what the marketplace demands, and so on and so forth. The argument goes that the internet was doing just fine before net neutrality. Remember, it was enacted in 2015. So the internet went a long, long way and did, you know, I think A-okay before net neutrality came along. And perhaps the net neutrality in 2015 addressed a problem that wasn't there. Now, the worry for me as a consumer is different. And it comes from contemplating how going back to a net neutrality-free world would actually work. And, you know, as a consumer, I don't know about you, I'm already paying a premium for high-speed internet access, not only for, of course, recreational use, but I also rely on it for professional use in my home office, as do, you know, many others across Wisconsin and millions upon millions, you know, across the United States. And I'm frankly not at all convinced that my internet service provider has my best interest at heart.
Let's go
A lot of listeners have their own horror stories about service and performance from their service provider as well.
Let's go to Phil in Mount Horeb with a concern. Phil, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm concerned about net neutrality as an individual investor. I do investing for my home. If I am throttled by the internet companies, I'm going to be disadvantaged in terms of the speed with which I can access the marketplace and make my trades. I'm also concerned that people aren't seeing the bigger picture here, which is gerrymandering and Citizens United are our major U.S. problems. And when we solve those problems, we will solve problems like net neutrality.
Well, Phil, thank you for calling in. This is Friday. It means we're rewinding on the week's developments on Week in Review. Chris Lotto is a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. John Nichols is the associate editor of the Capital Times and national affairs correspondent of The Nation magazine. You can join in 800-642-1234. How about the John Doe investigation? Is Attorney General Brad Schimmel right to call for disciplinary action in connection with the leak of documents on Governor Walker's campaign activities? Should the four Ethics and Elections Commission members named in the DOJ John Doe leak report quit? 800-642-1234 or post. Back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Combing through the week's news on this December 15th, it's Week in Review on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our commentators this week, Chris Lotto is with us, a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. And John Nichols is here, associate editor of the Capital Times and national affairs correspondent of The Nation magazine. You're with us as well at 800-642-1234. Moving on to the John Doe investigation. The Wisconsin Ethics Commission this week faulted Attorney General Brad Schimmel for, quote, omissions and inaccuracies in his investigation of leaked documents collected during the now closed probe into Governor Scott Walker. Chris, what do you make of this 88-page DOJ report?
Well, the ethics and elections objections feel like a smokescreen. It feels like something of a distraction from the possibly partisan and malicious actions that may have been engaged by some in the former Government Accountability Board here. You know, right now, the Attorney General Schimmel says there are no other leads to pursue to try and identify the source of the leaks to The Guardian. Schimmel has asked for contempt proceedings to begin against nine people and has indicated that may reveal some new leads, but there are legitimate questions around the scope and targets of the John Doe investigation. Frankly, the whole thing stinks. Why were more than a half million emails and other messages in the basement of the former Government Accountability Board? Why were thousands of private messages kept on GAB servers with folders labeled opposition research? Why were personal messages involving State Senator Leah Vukmir, among others, among these files? At the absolute minimum, the information was mishandled. And you can't help but wonder if a wide net was cast in a partisan effort to ultimately use it against Republicans. And I think there is more work to be done here to look deeper into this matter. And the pushback on some of the details of the report, again, just feels like an effort to distract from the larger questions here.
What were your takeaways, John, from this report?
My dad was the court commissioner down in Racine County for many decades and a prosecutor down there, and had to do a lot of investigations, a lot of reports in different capacities. And he always said that when you do something like this, when you put as a official in an official capacity, be it a county prosecutor, a court commissioner, a state attorney general, your fundamental responsibility, your first responsibility is to get it absolutely right, to have no question in what you're doing. To fail to do that is to create false premises that will go far beyond what you've done and potentially to imply illegal actions on people who are absolutely innocent and should never have been implied to have done wrong except for your failure if you do that. I was raised in that culture. And so I have to tell you, I was shocked by Attorney General Schimmel's report. It contained inaccuracies, which he has acknowledged, trying to suggest that a reporter's wife was somehow involved with a leak of information when she worked in another area altogether. This was the top law enforcement officer of the state of Wisconsin taking rumors and fantasies and spinning them into an 88-page document, fundamentally flawed, as he has acknowledged in some components of it. He says he'll fix what he got wrong. But also in its partisanship. You know, when Chris said I'm trying to make sure I've got this right, possibly partisan and malicious actions, I thought he was talking about Schimmel's report because, you know, it was so drenched in a partisanship. Now, it's appropriate to look at the John Doe. I've never been a fan of John Doe inquiries. I think they're too secret. I think there's a lot of problems with them. And I think it is very appropriate to ask questions about the overall practice of using John Doe's as well as the specific case here. But what Attorney General Schimmel did was shockingly inept, irresponsible. He did damage to his own position. And I hope that, I have to say, and I don't want to be too sharp on this, but I do hope voters will consider this come election time, because I think Wisconsin needs an attorney general who knows how to dot the I's and cross the T's.
Let's go to Nate, who would like to discuss this in Milwaukee. Go ahead, Nate.
Hi, thank you. I actually was going to use the phrase partisan and malicious myself when I heard it, because that's how I feel the Republicans have treated members of the Government Accountability Board, because you actually go back and look at what happened, and it is true that Scott Walker's campaign broke standing election law. They didn't like it. They didn't like that they got caught. And now they're basically treating investigators that did a job and did it right, I think, trying to vilify them for their own ends, which are very partisan. And I look at Scott Fitzgerald and Robin Voss's recent call for members of the Ethics Committee to resign. For basically recognizing that these are valuable workers, and I feel like the calls for resignation are actually coming from the people who should resign doing that.
Nate, thank you so much for calling in, and let's get Chris here to respond. Chris, go ahead.
Well, all I'll say is that, you know, there's always going to be, Democrats are going to come out and say, hey, our guys can do no wrong in the Government Accountability Board, the Ethics and Elections Board. Of course, that's what they're going to say, that they're blameless here. John is right in the sense that to the degree that Schimmel has to go back and fix some of the inaccuracies that he included in his initial report. That's on Attorney General Schimmel, and John is right. He is going to have to answer for that. But I think the larger questions of how the evidence was handled still remain, and we're just trying to sort of dance around how this investigation was conducted and what was done with the information that was gathered and why such a giant net was cast in the first place.
So we get now this report that says John Doe 3. Chris, what are you watching for as this thing proceeds?
Well, our hands are tied, as John said. I mean, there is secretive nature to these John Doe investigations, so it is hard to say. And again, because such a wide net was cast, you know, who knows what's going on? Who knows what's being looked for here? I do, to a certain extent, you know, agree with what John said. We can't know for sure. But I think, again, it goes back to my primary point about the amount of information being gathered, what is actually germane to any potential investigation that's going on, and what, you know, is sitting in a basement that could possibly be weaponized to use against candidates for office and legislators in Wisconsin.
Let's bring in Peter in Madison. Go ahead, Peter.
Hi, I think the John Doe investigation was probably a mistake, and the way to defeat Scott Walker is to just beat him at the ballot box. I hope the Democrats really focus on a strategy in 2018 that can really drive people to the polls and beat Scott Walker. I think they should focus on expanding broadband to rural parts of Wisconsin, and also another thing that they can offer to encourage voters is expanding Medicaid. Right now, the federal government would cover 90% of a Medicaid expansion, but Scott Walker is just giving that away just because he wants to be strong on the Obamacare thing for political reasons. So I hope the Democrats – I'm also curious what John Nichols thinks of the Democrats that are running and the strategy for 2018.
Thanks, Peter. John Nichols, you're on.
Hey, I didn't put Peter up to that. I honestly don't know who he is. But what I will say is this. I think he's absolutely right. Look, our politics is corrupt from top to bottom. It's a mess. Russ Feingold is right. Campaign paying contributions are legalized bribery, and both parties are in terrible shape. And so when we begin with that concept, if you were to frame a campaign against Scott Walker on simply corruption in his administration or wrongdoing by people associated with him, I don't think you get to the heart of the matter. People need to be talking about fundamental issues in people's lives. I think the Foxconn deal is a scandal that most Wisconsinites are going to be upset with. That's a good thing to talk about. Medicaid expansion, the other things brought up here. As regards the candidates, I love that there's a primary. I think it's wonderful that Democrats have a great big multi-candidate primary. And it's interesting that I met the other day with a young man who is preparing to enter the Republican primary as a moderate opponent to Scott Walker. So I think we should have multi-candidate primaries. I'm not going to tell people who I think is best. What I'm going to say is get all these candidates on WPR and let's have a lot of shows and a lot of debates.
Okay, well, you segued here into our final discussion point. Some of the Democratic candidates were in Eau Claire this week for a forum sponsored by liberal-leaning advocacy groups. Discussion ranged from whether investment firms could buy farmland to whether the state should establish a defined benefit retirement plan for private sector employees, similar to the Wisconsin retirement system. Overall, the common theme of the afternoon was the need to rally behind a candidate who would be able to beat Governor Scott Walker next November. John, quickly here, because I want to give Chris the last word. What do you make of the candidate in the fields?
What do I make of the candidates in the field? I think it's a fine field of candidates. One thing to remember is that in the history of Wisconsin, it's been a very, very long time since a Democrat got elected who didn't come out of a multi-candidate primary. You have a statewide elected official. You have a prominent legislator. You have lots of other folks. So I think we're right on track for a classic Democratic primary race. And at the end of the day, whoever is nominated will be running against Scott Walker in the first election that Scott Walker has had to face the voters of Wisconsin without being able to blame a president. Remember, that's an important thing. So we have an opening here where a Democrat can run not just against Scott Walker, but also against Donald Trump.
And Chris, final word here, candidate or candidates you're watching in this classic primary coming through.
Boy, they have a big bench of people on the Democrat side, don't they? Was it 12 plus or something showed up in Eau Claire this week? I think that, a bit of free advice for Democrats is don't try to run against Trump and don't try to run against, but try and run for. And I think that's what I think voters, no matter what political stripe you are, crave. They want to hear positives. They want to hear how you're going to address things. They don't want to hear attack. They don't want to hear Scott Walker stinks, vote for me.
Chris and John, thank you so much. Chris Lotto, former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin. John Nichols, associate editor of the Capital Times. This hour, the morning show was produced by Brianne Shasso, Chris Molina, and Bill Martins. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.